I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Ana Pacheco. She's founder and publisher of La Herencia magazine, and her new book is called Legendary Locals of Santa Fe. She'll be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow night, Tuesday, at 6 in the evening. She will also be speaking on May 23rd, that's a Thursday, at Bookworks in Albuquerque. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. Good morning.
Good morning. So Legendary Locals is kind of a series. Are there legendary locals all over the country, books that are compilations of the stories of local people?
There are. As a matter of fact, this publisher, Arcadia Publishing, they publish several different types of books, but their Legendary Locals is their most successful product. And so they're all over the country.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a state that they're not in. So
yeah, there's a map in the back of the book which shows where all of these legendary locals are.
Heavy concentration on the East Coast, but even and on the West Coast, but even spread throughout the country, you'll see that, like I said, I don't think there's a state that has not had one of these legendary local books published.
And so what happened? They approached you and said, will you put one of these together?
Exactly, that's what happened. It was February of 2011. And I should just point out to the audience, I'm the former publisher and editor of La Herencia. La Herencia went out of business in 2009 because of the economy. But since 2007, I've had a weekly column in the Santa Fe New Mexican called A Wonderful Life, where I document the oral histories of our community elders. And because they're on the, they have a website and they're on the internet, apparently this editor has been reading my work in the New Mexican, and so they approached me and asked me if I'd put this together for them.
And so how did you do that? I mean, because this is really a historical book. It starts with people who were, what's the very first thing in here? And not all of the legendary locals are actual people.
Well, the very first thing is La Llorona.
La Llorona.
The tale of La Llorona. And I guess I'll just kind of backtrack. Fortunately, because I did publish La Herencia for 15 years from 1994 through 2009, I had all this historical background information because of having done this for 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, that the archives that you have are such an important part of our history.
And most of it has never been documented in this one, this one format, La Herencia. So I had a lot of that. So for instance, I started with the tale of La Llorona, which was done in the early days of La Herencia, because for Hispanics, we've always had this tale of La Llorona, the weeping woman who cries for her children. But basically, one of the professors that used to write for La Herencia, he had put together an interesting story, which I like the best of all the tales of her, and it basically talks about La Llorona was an Indian princess named La Malinche, and she was the mistress of Coronado back in Mexico in 1520, and so she's banished from her tribe, and so she spends the rest of her life so it's really not her children is just a metaphor for her lost culture. And I thought that was a beautiful way to start out this book on Santa Fe, because with every influx of a different culture, a little bit of the culture is lost.
That's
and so
right.
I thought that was a great way to start it off.
And most of the book is people, and again, we're going back to historical people who lived in the 19th century, and Archbishop Lamy is in there, and Adolf Bandelier is in there, and then lots of people we've never heard of, or I've never heard of until I looked through this book. How did you find them? How did you decide who was going to be in it?
Well, see, again, some of these, that was the other nice thing about having done this column now for the New Mexican for almost 5.5 years is, I've encountered some incredible people. So part of those people are included in the book. And then other people like Tommy Massioni, who was this eccentric artist. I grew up in Santa Fe. This is my hometown.
Yeah.
So I remember I was a 13-year-old, and I remember this crazy artist, and back then it was still considered a pretty small town, and everybody was like, there's Massioni. So people like that, I just happened to know. Somebody like Sam Leyba, who's in the public service chapter, I actually went to high school with him. He was part of the Chicano movement, and so back in the early 1970s, he and I were colleagues, we were friends. So certain people I've just known, Godfrey Reggio, he's another fascinating character. He's
Indeed.
This incredible film documentarian, and now all over the world famous. But when I knew him, again, I was probably 11 or something, he was a Christian brother at the College of Santa Fe. And so there was this huge, he's about 6'5", foot five or 6 foot seven, this towering, you know, huge, you know, giant man in a brother's, you know, the Christian brother's robe. And he was just, so, to me, he was just like this incredible guy. You know, I saw him as a great man then, and I was just a little kid, and then to see all the things that he did. So some of these people I just grew up around.
Right, and there are really chapters that give such a feel of different parts of the town. So there's a military service chapter, and so you've got veterans in there and all kinds of folks. And then you've got sports and business and entertainment, art, literature, history, and public service. And so again, there's some people who died very young. There's some people who died in their 20s and 30s and even children. And then there's some people, I think the oldest one lived to be 109.
That was the first Fiesta Queen, Amalia Sena. Yeah. But I have to tell you about, in terms of, I followed a template. Again, this is why Arcadia Publishing is so successful. They have a formula, and it works all over the country. So when they contacted me, they said, here is your template. So I had, they're the ones who had all these chapters, and so they know that's kind of a great, nice way to approach a legendary local format, because you're getting people from these different areas of society, and that basically tells the story. I mean, I'm sure we could have come up with maybe something else, but really, entertainment, sports, military service, business. I mean, these would be the areas where people make a difference, that they impact our communities.
And it gives you a sense of all the different parts of the community that kind of hold it together, that make the world go round.
Exactly.
Without the people contained in any of these chapters, society sort of falls apart. Everybody does their little part. And, for example, including not only people, but buildings. So La Fonda is in here, and the Lenzic is in here, and those are their own kinds of, they make their own kinds of contributions.
Well, the nice thing about that, again, the Lenzic and La Fonda are in my business chapter, and they have, you know, they've been here for so long that it's important that they're, I mean, with all of these chapters, anybody listening to this program this morning, you know, any of these chapters, history, literature, art, entertainment, sports, business, military, and public service, they touch each and every person listening to this today. So for business, everybody's gone to a performance at the Lenzic. I mean, who hasn't eaten at La Fonda or had somebody from out of town come and stay there? I think the nice thing about this was all the photos. You know, that was part of the assignment, was to come up with interesting photos. So there's this one photo of La Fonda in the 1950s during Fiesta, and half the town is hanging off the roof there. I mean, that could never happen today with, you know, liability and
safety.
I mean, what isn't that? Isn't that so neat? So I think it just gives a good sense of Santa Fe in its innocence or something before we all had to adhere to all these different rules and regulations.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose there's a lot gained when you have safety and regulations, but there's a lot lost also.
Well, in this day and age, you can't live without it.
Right. We're talking to Ana Pacheco about legendary locals of Santa Fe. Now, were there any people who you discovered in the making of this book who you hadn't known through your column and through La Herencia?
There were several. As a matter of fact, I have to thank Kimi Ginoza Green. She's a very active person in the community, and she's got her hands in not-for-profits, in the green industry, all these different things. And so she was the one, because I had to come up with younger people. I don't want the book just to be people that are much, much older.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, but you know, to be considered a legend, you have to have been around. So I kind of like capped it off at about 30. And so then she was able to help me come up with several different people that work in different areas that I wasn't familiar with. One of my favorites is a woman, her name is Janine, I think it's Casal, and she's a master gardener, and she...
Cabusel. We had her on the air last week. She grows these giant pumpkins.
Is this incredible? I know, so there's this photograph with her and this 448-pound pumpkin. I thought that was so cute. As a matter of fact... last Saturday, she was at the county fairgrounds, and they had this big garden fair. Exactly. So she's an important part of our community, and just different people. And then I should point out, you were saying that some younger people are in there. You know, people like Marty Sanchez. I had no idea. You know, the Links to Santa Fe is you know, Marty Sanchez. That's name. It's Marty Sanchez Links to Santa Fe Golf Course with a city out there on 599. And it turns out, you know, he was this incredible young man, didn't even make it through college. He got this terrible type of cancer, And he died at such a young age. And so there's this great photo of him, you know, playing.
Beautiful photograph of him. It's playing golf, and he's right in the middle of the swing. Oh. I don't know how they got that photograph.
And those legs, his gorgeous legs. Oh, my God. But it was so sad because he was, you know, his dream was to be a professional golfer, and his dreams were cut short. And how wonderful for the city. I think it was either Larry Delgado or Sam Pick were in office when they, I don't know how they decided to do this, but to give, you know, to name it after this young man whose dreams weren't completely realized. Yeah. I think that's wonderful. So, in other words, buildings don't have to be named after people that are old and have done an incredible, you know, huge things. But somebody like that who had a dream and inspiration, and I thought it was wonderful.
And there's also this thing when, for example, parks are named after people, you say the name a million times, but you don't know who that is, and a book like this puts names to those places.
Well, I have to tell you, when the book first came out, I was the one who put together the first book signing, and I specifically wanted it at the Genoveva Chavez Center. She's on the cover of the book. She's in the book. I work out there 4 and 5 days a week, and I actually knew Genoveva when I was a little girl. She played at all the Fiesta de Santa Fe performances, and again, to me, she was like a movie star. I mean, it was having like Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, and so I knew her, and then years later, when I came back to New Mexico after living in New York, and I started La Audiencia, I got to know her again, and we wrote about her in La Audiencia, and then she died, which was, you know, she died, I thought she was only in her 50s when she died, and that's not young like Marty Sanchez, but still, I mean, I thought her life was cut short, and so my kids, you know, they went swimming there as toddlers and things, and they only knew the place as the GCCC. And I thought to myself, well, she certainly needs to be in the book because, you know, a lot of people that have just moved here or young kids, they don't really know that this is named after this mariachi singer.
Right, right.
I think that's cool.
What's such a beautiful name, Genoveva.
Isn't that nice? Yeah, she was a neat, neat lady. And so glad and I to have the first book signing at the building named after her. That was so nice.
Now, there are other folks like Betty Boyce Stewart, whom I had not heard of, but she was a tremendous animal lover, among other things.
Well, I had heard about her. I had never, she passed away long before I was doing this column for the New Mexican, and she wasn't in La Audiencia because it was all about Hispanics, but I had heard about her, and I think it was when I was down at the animal shelter or something, it said, you know, the brand new animal shelter, I think it was for the opening, it said, you know, thanks to the generous contribution of, you know, by Betty Boyce Stewart, you know, they have this center, and I thought to myself, I mean, if anybody has impacted this community, this incredible facility, remember for years that poor little animal shelter on Cerritos Road, it just wasn't big enough to accommodate the growing needs of Santa Fe. So here we have this top of the line, facility now with plenty of space where dogs can walk and all types of things. And it was because of this woman who was a construction worker. I thought not that she was a construction worker, she owned a construction company. And I thought it was so incredible that this woman back in her day, I mean, you didn't have a lot of women owning construction companies. And what was unique about her is that she built, she would build these really cool houses, not like your typical, you know,
spec houses.
Exactly.
Generic,
right. She would go and she would find, you know, antique doors from old adobe. She was building what I would call art house.
Yeah,
I
mean, she was an artist.
She was an artist, yes. So that was so cool.
And pictured here with her little Jack Russell Terrier.
Isn't that a nice, so she was so glad that I was able to get her in the book as well.
So lots of people and also performing arts of all kinds and visual arts of all kinds. So Zobra, of course, is in it, and many literary figures, legendary locals of Santa Fe. So this is a book that's for sale kind of all over the place. I was in Hastings the other day, and there it was. It's in Collected Works bookstore. So you're really placing it in places where local people go.
Well, again, that's another, that's part of Arcadia's business model, which I think is interesting, is that when they did approach me to do the book, it wasn't like they just said, okay, Anna, and I said yes. I had this like 32-page author guideline that I had to fill out. I had to let them know where I thought the book might do well. So in addition to being in regular traditional outlets like bookstores, you'll find it at Tia Sofia's, at Santa Fe Lock and Key, at Tico's Herb Shop, the Guadalupe Barbershop, just different places that you wouldn't typically find books, but that's where locals hang out. That's where locals go. So I think, and so it's their business model is working well.
And it's really a wonderful book. I mean, I really recommend it for people who live here, whether they live here full-time or whether they're passing through or live here part-time, because it's really a way of getting to know the town And not just the kind of superficial touristy aspects of the town.
Yeah, because it's it shows the real Santa Fe. You know, the people, you know, it talks about when St. Mike's and Santa Fe High were rival schools. This is before we had Capitol High and all these charter schools. It shows like the small town that it was, and so it just gives you a real sense of what brought this community together. For instance, the LaSallian Christian Brothers and the Loreto Nuns. I mean, they were responsible for educating all our parents, our grandparents. Yeah. So they've had an incredible impact.
And these are the things also, I mean, when you think about culture and how cultures change, the layers that were there before, they don't go away that quickly, and they still inform who we are as a town.
Well, yeah, the way I kind of see it is kind of like a fabric, you know, different fabrics on top of what they just kind of lie on top of one or the other, and it just becomes like this nice, beautiful quilt or something. But that's what I was saying but that's why I started off the book with La Llorona, because with every new influx of a culture, something is gained, but something is lost.
And it's interesting, too, because just this weekend we had a performance of excerpts of the opera La Llorona by Daniel Stephen Kraft, who uses the exact version that you were talking about with La Malinche.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's something to watch for in future performances. They've never actually performed the whole of it. But anyway, that's another subject. Ana Pacheco is the founder and publisher of La Herencia. Is it still on the web?
Well, actually, right now I'm trying to do something where I can provide all. I have all the. You know, it's an incredible piece of documentation. So
it is.
So I'm trying to get a new website up, but it's taking some time here. But it will be back. It was on the web, but now I'm trying to do something a little differently where people can just get the whole 65 issues all at once. I have this incredible index. I mean, a lot of work went into this publication.
I know.
I've got this 350-page index. It's all searchable. I mean, but within this summer, that's one of my projects.
Well, when you do that, you can come back, because it'll be an important resource to have on the web for people who want to search the past, all those past issues that you've done. Meanwhile, the new book is called Legendary Locals of Santa Fe. It's published by Arcadia, and you will be speaking, Ana Pacheco, tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore right here in Santa Fe on the corner of Galisteo and Water, and then again on May 23rd, which is a Thursday, at Bookworks in Albuquerque at 7 in the evening. They do wonderful programs down there at Bookworks as well. Legendary Locals of Santa Fe can also be found at legendarylocals.com with all the other legendary locals in this country.
And, of course, Amazon has it. I should also point out for tomorrow's book signing and reading, Lori Franz, she's the author of The Turquoise Trail, another Arcadia imprint. She'll be joining me for the book signing.
Excellent.
And I think what Arcadia's done is, I think they go state by state, and there's all kinds of Arcadia books that I've seen now. I see them at Walgreens and different places, but there's one on Catholics along the Rio Grande. There's things on Albuquerque. There was something on Chimayo. There's something on Los Alamos. So basically their approach is they contact local writers and historians and ask them to do these little different segments. And then they're probably in Arizona by now or something.
Right.
That's how I think they work.
Well, Ana, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so very much, and appreciate all that you do for us. You're truly a legendary local also.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'd like to welcome back to the show, they're here every year, Carl Ferguson of the St. Vincent Hospital Foundation, and Ben Swan, who's here considerably more often than every year, of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, here to talk about Paws for a Cause. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for inviting us.
So this is a great community event that happens every May, and it's happening this coming Saturday, the 4th of May, in the morning. Now, what's Paws for a Cause? What's the pause and what's the cause?
Let's pause for a cause. Now, Paws for a Cause is a great event that started with Carl and the St. Vincent Hospital Foundation, in which we were trying to find ways to get people and animals active and healthy. And I thought it was a great combination to get the shelter involved in it, and we've been doing it for about 3 or 4 years now, just sort of building on that success that he started. He started in a dog park many, many years ago, just sort of very casually, and it's become really a fun event. The good thing about it is the Paws for a Cause is really paws, feet, and the cause is the cause. It benefits the shelter and the St. Vincent Hospital Foundation. And it's just an opportunity for people to, it's a very casual but fun event where people get together and, well, some people will go off on a 10K run, and that's along the Santa Fe River Trail, and other people will go to the plaza. And this time, this year, as it was last year, is led by Nicole Brady. She's the KOB news anchor and very much an animal lover. And she's just a lot of fun to have there. Sort of gives it our star quality. It's just a... Go ahead,
right.
Carl. You can
well, explain. No, and the other reason why we really started it was we heard complaints in the community that there were so many fundraisers and that all these nonprofits weren't collaborating. So we thought, here's a great way to collaborate with another great organization and try to do something together. And it's, you know, everybody in Santa Fe loves dogs, and so here's a great way to be outside on a beautiful Santa Fe day and walk to the plaza and have a great fun time. So that's really another reason why we did it.
Right, and every year we try to enhance it, give it a different kind of a twist. Sorry, I was trying to think of a canine pun, but you'll have to help me out with some kind of canine twist to make it, anyway, exciting. But we have a market place where after the walk, and then usually people are done about 10 or 10:30, they come back and we have demonstrations and we have these great sponsors who set up tables and really use the connect with the community in a way that's really cool. And the vendors this year are pretty awesome. We're going to have an Ask a Vet, we'll have an Ask a Trainer and different things like that, that people can really get involved and learn more about their animals and their self through healthy choices and things like that.
And so people can run. If they don't like to run, they can walk. You can take your dog with you.
Or not.
Or not. Can you run the 10K with your dog?
Well, we discourage that because some dogs just aren't meant for that. It really depends on the person. You know, we're not going to tell people they can't do it, but we just don't think it's a good idea. But we'll let people decide for themselves if they feel their dog is.
Plus, dogs have to be on a leash, and so running with a leash and other people, it can become quite dangerous. But we've had a few people run.
Yeah.
You have to have a really good dog.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some people came and, some dogs were just like taken off and were like, you could tell they were total run dogs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, then there's some people that show up with this dog that looks like it has not been out of its little cage, its little basket in like 12 years. And that dog cannot run 10K. Yeah.
It's could be a lab dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And some dogs are just very exuberant and they get in the way of other runners and stuff.
Right.
So
I still... and always recommend the film, the documentary Wiener Takes All, which is about dachshund racing.
Yes.
And the best part of the film is the preliminaries where the dogs that don't really even know how to go out of the gate are being qualified.
Exactly. No, and that's a great event, actually. It takes place every November down in Albuquerque, actually one of the races that lead into that. And we've taken both of our dachshunds there. And actually,
have you raced your dachshunds?
Yes, we raced our dachshunds. And actually, they did exactly what they did in the movie, where our Ziggy, one of our dachshunds, they had to do 4 heats just with his heat times because they walked out and they all just like stood there out there and they sniffed each other. They looked around.
That's
there's
so
like
funny.
100 people screaming at them, and they were like, what are these people screaming at me for?
I know. There's like, come on, dogs, race. And they're like, but we want to sniff each other and say hello.
Yeah. That's why
and
I
have
like
a little tea party.
That's why I like the puppy bowl right before Super Bowl where all the puppies are going like, hey, I'm cute. And where am I supposed to go? And
right.
Anyway, but it's not like that at all. we're much more, let's not say organized, but animals know where they're going.
You
and
are
so the people.
Organized.
Yes.
You are very organized. The Paws for Causes, that's one of the things that's beautiful about it. It's actually a well-run event.
And you know what's a good thing about it is that it does get people out and about. And some people, it takes place at Alto Park. That's right across from the Solana Center, down a little ways by the swimming pool.
Right, the swimming pool and near NDI.
Yeah. West Alameda. People forget how beautiful our community is and how much that we've improved our trails. And, a lot of people, what's interesting, a lot of people who do the Pause for a Cause event and walk to the plaza, they haven't been to the plaza since last year, because people just tend to not go there as much as they used to.
And one of the fun things that we do is when we get down to the plaza, we do stop and we take a group photo of everybody with their dogs, and it's really kind of a fun time. So if you we'd love to see people out there, and we know a lot of Santa Fe people do not get down to the plaza that often, so come with us on
so
Saturday.
How do you actually, where's the money raising part of it?
It's a registration fee.
Oh, right. Okay.
And then there's stuff that you can buy. This year we're going to have some contests, a raffle ticket, and things like that.
And we have sponsors.
Oh, yeah, definitely the sponsors are the ones that actually help us sponsor this this event.
We do have a couple large sponsors that I want to mention, United Healthcare and Arrighetti Animal Hospital.
Right, and Joey and Hannah of Santa Fe Tales, they've always been a big sponsor, and they've always loved helping us out. They're great people. They help us with the contests as well. I don't know, Mary Charlotte, have you done any of the contests? Best kisser, the best tail wagger, the best look-alike?
Most look like their owner.
I could enter that.
You have that stunned look on your face. I'm not asking you to wiggle your butt.
I mean, I could enter that with my dog, Honey.
Yes, definitely.
Who I think I look like, sort of. Yes.
But when you say that's that one contest, most looks like owner, is the most interesting every year, because you think, well, people don't really look like their dogs, but all of a sudden we get like two or three people that actually really look like their animal, and
it's
funny.
Yeah. So, Paws for a Cause coming up this weekend, Saturday the 4th of May. Registration is at 8 in the morning. The 10-kilometer run is at 9 in the morning, and shortly after that is the walk.
Right.
With or without dogs.
Right, and so you can also register online at our website, sfhumanesociety.org, or active.com.
Yes.
So we're trying to encourage, you know, the 10K run is, people love to run here, and the Santa Fe Trail is so beautiful, so that really, really works well with that, and we're trying to encourage that aspect of the Pause for a Cause. But, you know, you come back and you relax, and you eat, and just have a lot of fun.
It's a community day, and it's always, I mean, it's such a nice time of year. Chances are it's not snowing in May, although you never know.
Never know. Hopefully the 40-mile-an-hour winds have stopped by then.
We've been very fortunate. The weather, I think only once in the last 5 years, it's been kind of windy and wet.
Right.
And that's even, you know,
right.
Luckily in Santa Fe, it just lasts for 10 minutes and it's right. over with.
So, meanwhile, the last yes. time you were on the show, Ben Swan, there was a situation where somebody who was a dog hoarder had been found, and the dogs were at the animal shelter. You want to update us on that situation?
Sure. We are still in a kind of a holding pattern, and I just wanted to tell you how much it's incredible how much the community has come forward to help us out in this really difficult time, in that we took in 48 dogs overnight, and that meant we had to really clean out our shelters to make space for them, in that we partner with other kennels and things to get our existing dogs to those places where we could have room for them. And now our resources are still being taxed, because we still have these dogs, and just yesterday one of the dogs had puppies, so we have eight more. So the puppies are very cute, but you know, we encourage people to spay and neuter their animals, and we have four more mothers probably that are coming along
in this hoarding
situation.
Good
yes
heavens.
We have talked, we've reached out, we basically want to do the right thing with the animals. We want to be able to spay and neuter them. We want to be able to fix their behavior problems. We want to be able to foster them. We want them out of the shelter. We want to have them have happy homes. And the person involved in this case has until May 10th before she has to decide if she relinquishes them to us, or she has to pay a certain amount of money per animal per day. We hope that she'll do the right thing and just decide to relinquish them to us. And so we're working with her to really, you know, understand that that's the best course for the animals.
Well, per animal per day gets multiplied every time there's more puppies.
Exactly. And, you know, and we just want to get these puppies to homes. Imagine if we had to do eight more kennels for these eight puppies in 3 months. It'd just be crazy. Heavens. So we only have like 65... kennels in the intake part of our shelter, and that's 48. You know, it just takes a lot of space.
So pretty soon, if the dogs are relinquished, there will be a lot of good dogs up for adoption. I mean, I have to say that I saw pictures of some of them. I haven't seen them in person yet or in dog yet, but it looks like there's some nice happy animals.
Yeah, there are, especially the puppies. The puppies, some are 3 months old. They won't have any trouble finding homes. And they were, even those dogs were a little bit shut down, the puppies, when they first came in. But our behavior department and just about everybody who comes in and works in our shelter has been working with them to bring them out of their shells. And sometimes it's just amazing how they will come out of their shells. I've been sitting with this one beautiful black dog, and she was so shaking so much when I first saw her. And every day that I see her, she comes a little bit closer. And just yesterday, she came up and licked me on my cheek.
Oh.
So it takes time. And that's what we want to give these animals time and so they can find forever homes.
Now, you have some animals that are up for adoption.
Yes, I do. And I know that you have, I've already given her a peek.
I've had a sneak preview
so
of
you
a
want
German
to talk about Cupid.
Shepherd mix called Cupid. I mean, I don't know what she's mixed with, but she's pretty German Shepherd looking.
Very much so.
And an incredibly handsome 4-year-old spayed female dog. And available for, oh, maybe she's got some husky in her. But anyway, she's
looks
got
like she's
the,
a little bit of husky, yes.
The pointy ears and the deep, intelligent gaze into the camera. And she's available at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter.
Yeah, and this, and Cupid would be awesome for hiking or something. You know, huskies are just, they just create a bond with you. And they love to, and they're very quiet, I think, in a lot of ways. They love to go on trails and hikes with you or walks or just hang out with you at your foot, you know, at your couch. Things like that. And I also want to talk about our feline lovers. We have somebody named Moo. Moo is a, she's just an adorable little cat who's 11 years old. You know, we do get these some animals relinquished to us that are a little bit older, but I tell you, senior pets are very awesome animals to have. I always wait until about the 5th or 6th year before I realize that I can finally relax with my dogs. You know, it really sometimes takes 6 years before they kind of calm down.
I mean, from the time that they're puppies?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have now 3 dogs over the age of 9, and they're still active, wow. But they're wonderful dogs, and they've developed a rapport with each other and a real sense of their place in the home, and older pets are great.
They feel like they have this, I don't know, answers to all the world's questions, but they can't really tell you that, so you have to,
right? You have to get it out of them.
Yeah. You just look at them, and all of a sudden, you're enlightened. I know that they just do help you relax and just enjoy life.
I mean, just completely bypass the entire meditation process and look into the eyes of an elder animal.
You know, that's
done.
The best thing about animals is that they're always in the present.
That's so true.
Except maybe when they're waiting for their dinner.
It's 5 o'clock. Yeah.
Yeah, they're in the present, which is 1 minute from now.
Right.
Exactly.
Although they also, I mean, people say that they don't plan, but I'll tell you what, I have a dog who, for example, you'll go on a walk and he'll find a bone, and you take the bone away from him, and you'll throw it, and he'll say, okay, I remember exactly where she threw it, and tomorrow when she's not looking, I'm going to go back into that bush and get it. They're planning kind of dogs.
It's true. My dog Beta, once she found a squirrel in a tree, and for every day she thought that squirrel was in that tree. But of course it wasn't.
They stand there at the bottom and look up, and they're like,
exactly.
Yeah, I know you're there.
I know there was a tree. There was a squirrel there before. I bet there's one there now. Anyway, she never ever. One time she did catch a squirrel, and they were running together, and they both, it was like a movie moment where she caught the squirrel, she fell, they rolled around down a hill anyway, and the squirrel was all fine. I've never had very athletic dogs, but they do make for interesting stories.
Dog versus squirrel.
Right.
All right. Well, Ben Swan is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Carl Ferguson is with the St. Vincent Hospital Foundation. Pause for a Cause is this Saturday, the 4th of May, in the morning. And if people want to just show up on West Alameda across the street from the Solana Center, which has the Montañita Co-op supermarket, yes, and lots of other great businesses in there, they can just show up at 8 in the morning. And
yeah, we'll be there, Carl and I, and Nicole, and also Honey Harris, and she'll be...
Yay.
Yeah, she's a great person.
And lots of dogs.
Lots of dogs, hopefully, and some available for adoption. And just come out, have some fun.
All right.
Meet us.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks
for having
us,
Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Erin Elder. She's Visual Arts Director at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. And joining us by phone, artists Larry Bob Phillips and David Lee. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to be here.
So, Erin, tell us a little bit about what's going on, all kinds of things that you are working on at the CCA.
Yeah, there's always something new and exciting happening at CCA, and I'm really thrilled about this exhibition called The Big Hoot. It's in the front gallery at the Munoz Waxman in our warehouse space, and it involves Larry Bob and David Lee, who I don't believe have collaborated on this scale before. So when they approached me with their idea, I was thrilled. We love making things happen at CCA that are new and unexpected and a leap of faith. And I knew I could trust these guys because they make amazing work. It's floor to ceiling, wall to wall, kind of grotesque comics that just pop out and overwhelm in a really good way.
Now, the two of you, Larry, Bob, and David, are joining us from Albuquerque. Is this the first time you've actually collaborated?
Go ahead, Bob. Go ahead, Larry, Bob.
Yeah, that's a tough question. We've done a lot of stuff together. We ran a gallery together, which also published a journal. So we've written, curated, and exhibited together. But as far as working on the same project artistically, we haven't done too much of that.
Very interesting. I mean, these are large-scale kind of, I don't know if it would be offending to say, cartoon-like paintings. What are some of your inspirations?
Well, comics. You know, comics, cartoons, you name it. I think all those things, really filter into what I enjoy. I like to make, fairly absurd, grotesque, violent, but really funny drawings. And I think that, I think that's basically it. I mean, the essence of the comics that I like and the images that I like is that humor and that absurdity. And I think that definitely filtered into the piece that we worked on.
Also, I think, drawing on the vernacular of just maybe sign painting or something like that, like Mexican sign painting that we all, enjoy in our communities that's, under threat from the fast sign vinyl business, is a kind of vernacular and a straight ahead, just like, how do you draw a milk jug? How do you draw a carton of cigarettes? And then we sort of line everything with a black line that gives it a graphic sort of comic quality that keeps everything sort of in the same space. So you can draw pull something from Google Images, a bird in flight, say, and mix it right next to a fairly cartoon image of a skull or something like that, and they can all hold in the space together.
I mean, it's not like a comic book or graphic novel where there's words, but is there a kind of implied narrative in the installation?
I think that there's an open sort of narrative possibility between the images. It's a pretty postmodern piece in that way, in that where we select compelling, what we're calling pendants or isolated images, and then we curate them together later. So it's a collage in that way. So we build a narrative that, for this.
Yeah, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about how you created this work before the exhibition and then how you installed it in the gallery? It was really an interesting process to witness.
Well, it started off with us being in two separate studios. I was in my studio and Larry Bob was in his studio. And the basics of it were that we ordered a large amount of Luan, 4x8 foot Luan, so really thin sheets of a kind of plywood. And then basically what we would do is we would draw large-scale images on multiple pieces of this plywood and then paint it and then line it out, like Larry Bob mentioned, with the black key line. And then when they were finished, we would cut them out. And we started the project about 3 or so months ago, so we'd cut them out and then we'd store them. And so over the course of the past 3 months, I kind of moved into Larry Bob's studio, and so he would work on one side of the space generally, and I would work on the other. And our images, maybe they would inform one another, but by and large, we would just make an image, cut it out, and then store it. And then when we moved up to CCA, we loaded up a truck with all of these images and laid them out on the floor. Some of these images I don't think we had seen in weeks, maybe in a couple of months. And then at that point, we, like Larry Bob mentioned, we composed that narrative in CCA during the day of the installation.
And you know what you did, but is it meant to be a kind of work where you don't know which artist did what part of it?
In this particular collusion, it was it's really nice for us to sort of work toward one another in a way, so that when I look at the piece, I sometimes forget like who drew what, and that's a really good feeling to sort of just enjoy the piece that way.
I'm curious, people hear the word cartoon and comics and they think maybe for children. And I don't think of this exhibition as geared towards children necessarily. I think it has a lot of adult content, if you will. And I think there probably is a tradition of adult comics, and particularly in the art world, pop art and whatnot. I wonder if you can speak to why this grotesque, why space of horror, I think is one phrase you've used to describe this exhibition. And what is that all about for you guys?
Well, you know, I think the irony on my end is that I don't have a, you know, I'll admit that I don't have a real deep awareness of the history of comics, per se. But I think in terms of the approach for this, I mean, I'm going to see if I can find a good way to say this. I like trying to maybe hit at some harder themes in a way that I want to say fairly simplified in high key color, you know, high key colors, trying to mix this idea of humor and comedy with things that feel a little heavier. And I feel like there's a way too that it kind of overwhelms you. You know, the color and all these things overwhelm you in a different way than the content does, if that makes any sense. You know, you have these bright yellows and these bright greens and these bright reds, and they're sort of separated in some way from, I think, what you refer to as adult-themed content. I sort of feel like I need to throw a line to Larry Bob here and kind of save me on this one.
Well, I was going to speak a little bit to the history of the graphic arts. And Art Spiegelman, in an interview in a book called Dangerous Drawing, said that comics didn't come out of kids' culture. It actually came out of Central and Northern Europe in the late 17 and early 1800s, which to that date was probably the most graphically literate culture on the face of the planet. They had access to all kinds of paintings, all kinds of literature, and all kinds of drawings and prints, and they developed sequential art out of that. And in the exhibition, we have drawn on or sort of paid homage to a few important 20th century American graphic artists, specifically Harvey Kurtzman, whose two-fisted comics on the EC label in the 50s actually were censored and developed a comics code because a McCarthy-era sort of culture decided that comics like that weren't meant for kids because they told the truth about World War II and the Korean War.
Very interesting indeed. And, I mean, I think one of the other things that's just so great about the whole comic genre is a lot of them are done by people who are just so incredibly masterful at their craft. I mean, people who do comics, good comics, can really, really draw and have chosen not to do quote-unquote fine art.
Yeah. That's a big deal. You know, when you choose your stylization, you know, it's a political act. When you choose your format, it's a political act. When you choose your scale in some ways, you know, it's you're defining yourself within these traditions. So, and the tradition is so full of people working in different formats in different ways. So us going sort of over the top or super large was a way of engaging architecture, or sort of engaging the viewer's body in a new way. So we're excited to push it.
This exhibition is overwhelming. Like I said, it's 16 feet tall and 75 feet wide or more, and there's a 10-foot wide frying pan with an egg in it. There's a 4-foot tall bullet. I don't know if I have the dimensions correct, but it feels overwhelming, and there's these big splashes of blood, or I don't know what other kind of liquid it is, but you were definitely intentional about your scale and about the images that you made, and I think even George Bush is in one of the vehicles.
Always.
Is there a political commentary going on in this work?
Probably. I mean, I think that I think from my point of view, you know, when it started to come together last week during the installation, you know, I definitely felt there were a lot of a lot more places that it could grow to, and definitely trying to extend perhaps the maybe a more of an overt political direction is maybe what it'll lead to after this. But yeah, I think some of that was on our minds while we were making these things, and then as we put, and I'm trying to remember where George Bush might be. I feel like maybe it was maybe the Pope instead. But yeah, I think that those things were definitely on our mind. You know, we're real sensitive to obviously what's going on in the world today, and that it was impossible, I think, to keep it out of the images that we were making.
I think it's kind of easy to get locked into imagery where you got like Obama, you know, and how can you sort of upset that or get that to wiggle a little bit. And I think more of what came out of this exhibition is just the feeling of hysteria that itself is sort of like as a mindscape or a mind space where we're kind of at. You know, you turn on the news today and it's like some kind of diet salad, and then it's some rappers like exploits in South Beach next to a bombing hysteria or something like that. And I feel like we're sort of commenting on the mental space right now that we live in as much as sort of trying to construct a sort of airtight case against, you know, the use of drones, for instance.
The installation is called The Big Hoot, and it is at the CCA, the Munoz Waxman Gallery, here in Santa Fe, until the 12th of May. There's a closing reception with the artists on Friday, the 10th of May, at what time?
6 to 8 p.m.
6 to 8 in the evening. And then this coming Saturday at 8 in the evening, there will be a performance group coming from New York called Cheryl, who will be there also doing a performance. So I want to thank you all for being with us. Larry, Bob Phillips, and David Lee are the artists who did The Big Hoot, and Aaron Elder is visual arts director at the CCA. The CCA is on the web at ccasantafe.org. The number is 982-1338. Thank you all very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.